Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is an English fantasy author and champion of the video game industry. In 1975, while in his mid-20s, he founded the board game company Games Workshop, which soon caught the attention of the American creators of a new kind of tabletop game called Dungeons & Dragons. My guest brokered a deal to sell D&D in the UK as a mail-order company, and then opened the company's first retail shop in South London. In 1982, he published the first of the fighting fantasy books, which have now sold more than 20 million copies. He joined the video game industry and, at the publisher Eidos, helped bring the games Tomb Raider and Hitman to the world. Last year, he was honoured with a knighthood for services to the games industry. Play has always been seen as trivial, he once said. Yet when we arrive in this world, we all learn through it. Welcome, Sir Ian Livingstone.
A pleasure.
So I'm interested, you know, you, in that quote there, you talk about how play has always been seen as something trivial. As you know, I've written about games for a long time, and you often, you know, come up against a certain amount of skepticism from people who don't play games. How did it feel to receive a knighthood for working in this area, sort of from the establishment, who, you know, I guess many times in your career have rejected video games in one way or another?
It's probably, you know, long overdue, if not just for me. I'm obviously pleased to be the first, but there's an awful lot of deserving people in the industry who should be recognised in a similar fashion, because the games industry does speak to Generation Z. It does speak to today's entertainment medium. And those who've criticised games are probably ones who've never actually played a game. And if you think cognitively what's happening when you're playing a game, and just kind of part your prejudice against some of the titles that children shouldn't be playing, and they're 18 rated for a reason, and think what's happening inside somebody's head. Problem solving, you can't get through a game without problem solving, you're learning intuitively, you can fail in a safe environment, and the game encourages to play again until over time everyone can become a winner. And games like Minecraft, incredibly creative. Children can learn in context by applying the heat of a furnace to silica sand, they can create glass and put those in the environment. So it's effectively learning by doing. Games like Rollercoaster Tycoon, effectively a management simulation. You're managing a theme park, building the rides, understanding the physics, understanding the staffing levels required to run those rides, and the economy of pricing those rides. If you get it right, great. If you don't, you tweak the parameters until overtime. Everyone can be a winner. So everyone feels that feeling of success. And so I think games are a great contextual hub for learning. As an industry, I think it's been always under-recognized about the positive power of play.
Do you, as someone who speaks to MPs and I guess advocates for the industry in places where few other people do advocate for video games, have you detected a change in attitudes over the course of your career?
Absolutely. I think there's been a huge shift in recent years because though a lot of people now in power grew up with games, whereas I was starting off, we were treated like aliens, really. You're too old to be playing games, you know. How old are you? Stop that right now, as though it's a sort of strange pastime for people who get older. I mean, people play chess till then in the 90s. That's always been seen as okay. So why not board games? Why not role-playing games? Why not video games?
In fact, many people only take up bridge after they retire, don't they?
It's a perfectly natural phenomenon to be playing games. You know, they are culturally important. You see imagery of games in everything we do these days. We've seen how the games industry is now a $250 billion a year industry, bigger than music and film combined, and it speaks to Generation Z because it's interactive. It gives people agency. They're not passively watching some linear entertainment where the director's decided where the action will be. They're in control.
What were some of the games that you enjoyed playing when you were at school?
The games I played at school were Monopoly, and I used to play chess for school, but Monopoly I played fanatically, even though if you look back at its luck, it came of luck and negotiation. But yeah, I used to play an awful lot. And in 1975, I was playing in the British Monopoly Championship on Fenchurch Street Station, came second. Fortunately, if I'd won, I'd be able to go into the World Championships, but sadly not.
I had no idea they did a World Championships for Monopoly. That's amazing. And so, you know, obviously board games do play a major role in your life because this is what's in your mind when you come to set up Games Workshop. Can you just tell me about that, how that all came about and what the plan was?
Well, I was sharing a flat in southwest London, Shepherd's Bush, with two old school friends, Steve Jackson and John Peake. And we all shared a passion of blues music and playing games. And we decided, wouldn't it be great if we could turn our hobby of playing games into a business? We decided to publish a newsletter called Owl and Weasel. But it already starts out from John Peake, who was actually a civil engineer, but was also an incredible craftsman. And he'd made this backgammon board, and we thought maybe we could sell these. And that's really how it all kickstarted. And that's how the name of the company became Games Workshop, because the flat became a load of wood shavings and sawdust everywhere, as John and Steve as well also helped fabricate these boards. And I go out and sell them, and Steve would do the admin. So Steve Jackson, John Peake and I, we decided, let's go for it. And so we published Owl and Weasel, started selling our games mail order. And one of the copies of Owl and Weasel found its way to the desk in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, of Gary Gygax. And he wrote to us and said, love your magazine. Although we hadn't sent it to him directly, here's this new game I've invented. And that was Dungeons & Dragons. And it was kind of a pivotal moment for us, because when you open the box of D&D, I mean, the box itself didn't look very much in those days, but it opened up your imagination like no game had ever done before. I don't think any game ever will. This sort of milestone in gaming history, a role-playing game in which one person designs a labyrinth of passageways and dungeons and populates it with monsters and treasure, and the others take on roles of as being a hero or a wizard or a cleric and go on these fantastic journeys of the mind. Really theater on the fly, exploring dungeons, killing the monsters, finding the treasure. And these games would go on forever. And that was an amazing experience. So we ordered six copies of D&D. And on the back of that order, we got an exclusive 3-year distribution agreement for the whole of Europe.
So those six copies of Dungeons & Dragons that you bought, how quickly were you able to sell those on?
Pretty quickly. I mean, we advertised it in Owl and Weasel, even though the circulation of 50 copies, the news was spreading by word of mouth. Clearly, this is before the internet and before mobile phones, but there was a kind of network of gossip and rumors that was permeated throughout the gaming world, although it's a very embryonic games world, and the news spread and people heard about D&D and that Games Workshop, even though it wasn't a real business as such at that time, were the exclusive distribution agents for TSR. And we're living in this flat in Shepherd's Bush on the top floor, and we see people milling around on the streets down below and holding Alan Weir's in their hands looking for this shop, because they'd clearly expect to find a shop given the name of the company. We used to open the window and say, looking for workshop up here, mate. They come up into our kind of disorganized flat, and but still go away happy, having found a treasure in the form of a D&D box.
Wow, so they just come up the stairs and hand over their cash and walk out with a copy, would they?
Yeah, very happy indeed, even though we're surprised it wasn't a real shop.
Well, the format of the podcast, Ian, is that I'm asking you to choose the five games you'd like to install on your perfect video game console and bring out to the world. Can you tell us a little bit about your first choice?
Well, we're having to go back quite a long time, given I'm in my 70s now. But the one I played a lot in the very early days, was in the 1980s, was Intellivision Baseball.
Here's an easy question for you. Which of these games is the closest thing to the real thing? A, Intellivision Major League Baseball. B, Atari Baseball. If you thought A, Intellivision, you're absolutely correct. You see, I told you this question was easy.
Is it plug into your TV console with absolutely minimal graphics, a few pixels moving across the screen? But it had compelling gameplay, and I used to play with Steve Jackson when we used to share a flat in the very early days of Games Workshop. We used to stay in and play a lot of board games, but we discovered the Intellivision console and we played this endlessly. And we'd also had a strange fascination for baseball, but it was great gameplay. And when people ask me what are the three most important things about a game, I will say gameplay, gameplay, gameplay. Technology and graphics, of course, are crucial and vital, but they play a secondary role to gameplay itself. So Intellivision baseball was very thrilling. I mean, there's a keypad control players, and there were, and another thing, a bit like Lemmings, it was always a sound effect that resonated with you for a long time, but with Intellivision baseball, every time one of your players would out, the console would bark at you, you're out. And that, we used to say that all the time.
Do you remember how you got hold of the Intellivision console?
I can't actually remember where I bought it. Almost we'd heard about it in the States, because we'd been to the States several times by then. We first went to 1976 to go to Gen Con to meet Gary Gygax, to cement our relationship and also sign up for all the other fledgling games companies that were starting at the time. And again, people were talking about games, but Intellivision baseball didn't come out, I think, till 1980. So obviously a few years later, but I can't actually remember where and how I got it, but I did.
Did you feel, I suppose there can sometimes be a sense that people who play board games and tabletop games are slightly separate and distinct from people who play video games. Was there any of that sense of, or not quite rivalry, but distinctness, or did you feel that it was all, you know, pulling in the same direction and the same audience?
Well, it's based on play. One is analog and one is digital, but it's still play. And some people do both. Some just do one or the other. I do both. I'm sitting in a room here with, surrounded by 1,500 board games and several hundred video games, and I enjoy playing all formats. I mean, some people don't, but I don't think one industry is dominating the other. I mean, it's great to see the continued growth of the video games industry. At the same time, there's been a real resurgence in role-playing games and board games. I mean, Dungeons and Dragons has never been more popular in its fifth edition, I think, down to Stranger Things and Critical Role, the channel on YouTube played by actors acting out games of D&D had a huge resonance with new audiences. You've seen how all games have exploded onto the scene now, with Asmodee being bought by Embracer not long ago for around about $2 billion. And the reason why that's the industry has grown, the board games industry has grown, tabletop games have grown, is ironically because of the internet. In the old days, if somebody wants to publish their own game because a large publisher wouldn't publish them, they'd print 5,000 copies, of which 4,950 would probably end up in their garage because they couldn't get any distribution. So they, of course, through Kickstarter, effectively crowdfunding pre-sale of a game selling to a global audience, it really did risk a proposition. And of course, you can learn how to play online. There are boardgamegeek.com where you can see how games are rated, and all them, every game ever made is catalogued there. E-commerce, you can learn how to play from sites like Dark Tower. I mean, there's a whole digital ecosystem around the board games industry, which has enabled its growth and success. And I'm delighted by that because games, board games today are amazing. Some of the mechanics and the components are wonderful.
So it's 2 years after you found Games Workshop that you open your first physical store, I assume because of the success of D&D. That's in Hammersmith in South London. Can you tell me sort of how you went about that? What was in the store before you arrived, and what was it like that first day when you opened its door?
Well, the reason it came about was we actually started off workshop in our flat in Shepherd's Bush. Then when we returned from the States in 1976, by which time John Peake had left the company, Steve and I had to live in a van for 3 months because we couldn't get any cash into the business. The bank manager wouldn't have any idea about funding a games company in those days. We operated out of a small office at the back of an estate agent in Shepherd's Bush, to the point that it became totally crammed with boxes and people in and out of this one room. And so the estate agent said, look, this can't go on for much longer. And at the same time, we were getting frustrated that retailers weren't stocking D&D. So I said, well, why don't we open our own store? You know, we just had a conversation with Steve one evening and said to the stage agent, well, you should be able to find this a shop that suits our needs. And so they found this one in Hammersmith in Ravens Court Park. I think it was a hardware shop before that. I can't actually remember. So it was just perfect for us. It wasn't on a main road, but it was effectively a destination site for somebody who was wanted to find D&D and other role-playing games at the time. And we'd also built up demand for Workshop by that time because we'd started White Dwarf magazine in June 1977, and suddenly we had a much larger readership and sales were increasing. So we found the shop through our estate agent, but the official opening wasn't until the 1st of April 1978, and we were absolutely thrilled and delighted that it was a long queue outside waiting for it to open.
Amazing. Should we come to your second choice? Can you tell us about that? It's from 1992, I believe, a few years later. But how did you, what is the game and how did you encounter it?
Well, it was Championship Manager. When I eventually sold out of Games Workshop in 1991, I joined the company called Domark, who was operating in Putney. And how I'd got in touch with Domark is because of in 1984, the founders of Domark, Dominic Wheatley and Mark Strawn, came to me and said, would I write their first game, their launch products? They were marketing and advertising execs, and they wanted to get into the video games industry in the mid-80s, which was great. And they'd seen that my Death Trap Dungeon Final Fantasy game book was number one in the bestsellers list and thought I would be best for them to write their game. So I agreed to do that, and that game was called Eureka. It was programmed in Hungary for secrecy because of the £25,000 prize attached to the win of whoever solved the mystery inside Eureka. And somebody did, and I remember presenting the check on TV to a very happy young Matthew Woodley. It was my decision then to join Domark after selling out a workshop, and the only game I really was passionate about at Domark when I joined, not long after I joined, was Championship Manager. I was a mad football fan myself, and I'd spend endless hours, even though it was a very basic program at the time. It was written in C, but the players, it was all about management and the match, waiting for the matches to happen. I became completely obsessed with Championship Manager, or Champ Man as it was called over time. Of course, it was just testament to the Collier brothers who created this incredible simulation of managing a football team. And as a Manchester City fan, I try and take Manchester City to the glory that wasn't actually happening in those days.
Did you ever succeed?
Well, no. Not as well as I did, but I did try. I certainly put in the hours. I mean, I played it for a long, long time.
So you mentioned there that your route into the games and video games industry was via these books that you'd started publishing in the early 80s, the fighting fantasy books. How did the first one of those books come about? You know, obviously you're working in tabletop games. It's a bit of a leap to then start working on interactive books, I imagine. How did that happen?
Well, in the first year of Games Workshop, we decided to run an event called Games Day, which was happened in December 75. And by the time Games Day 79 came along, there was a significant number of attendees, and we had stands from other companies participating. And one of those was Penguin Books, and the editor of one of the books they had on sale was called Geraldine Cook, and she was bemused and fascinated by the passion and enthusiasm with which Dungeons & Dragons had been played by hundreds and hundreds of people at Games Day. And she said, Steve and I would we be interested in writing a book about Dungeons & Dragons, the phenomenon that it is becoming. And we said, rather kind of off the cuff, well, rather than writing a book about the hobby, why don't we write a book that allows you to experience role-playing? Uh-huh. And she said, oh, that's a really good idea. Send a synopsis. So we kind of lumbered us with a challenge. And Steve and I were then sharing a flat. Actually, managed to get out of the van by that time. And we came up with this concept, which we call the Magical Quest, with a book replacing the Dungeon Master and making a solo player experience. So it was a book in which you are the hero, you make all the choices, a branching narrative with the game system attached to it. So breaking the text into 400 paragraphs, which made no sense if you read them sequentially. But at the end of each paragraph, there was a choice. If you wanted to open the chest, turn to 77. If you want to walk past the chest and down the corridor, turn to 207. So you made a choice, and the consequence of that choice then rolled out. It was our job as really as writers to lure people to their doom. So we sent in this synopsis to Geraldine. She thought it was amazing. The management of Penguin Books apparently laughed so hard, one of them hit their head on the table. So it took another year for it to actually happen, and they decided they'd go on their Puffin imprint. So the Warlock of Firetop Mountain finally came out in 1982 without any fanfare or advertising. We promoted a bit through White Dwarf. It got off to a bit of a slow start, and until in certain schools, people heard about it. And that sort of virality of the day was the word of mouth in schools, and it passed from school to school, and it became kind of nationwide craze. And they reprinted Warlock probably 12 times in the first couple of months and said, we need some more. So Steve wrote City of Chaos, and I wrote City of Thieves, and then Death Trap Dungeon, and then the whole thing boomed. It became an international success and sold 20 million copies worldwide. That was how I really got into video games, by the furore of fighting fantasy attracting Mark and Dominic to ask me to write Yuri.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay.
Thank you.
That is extraordinary because, you know, that off-the-cuff remark made to the editor at Penguin, if you'd have said, oh, yes, yeah, sure, we'll do a more, I guess, sort of, you know, state of the industry, more journalistic nonfiction book, it would have been so different, wouldn't it? But it might be difficult for younger listeners to appreciate this today, but of course, around that time, there was a lot of controversy with Dungeons and Dragons and with your fighting fantasy books as well, the sort of, you know, darker fantasy themes that they explored. Can you just tell me what that was like to live through that? Did you feel, you know, really like you had a target on your back at that time?
Yeah, it definitely was there. There was, and it was called the Satanic Panic, and there was a lot of bad publicity going around Dungeons & Dragons in the United States, and with Final Fantasy game books, we got our fair share of it too. The Evangelical Alliance published an 8-page warning guide about Final Fantasy saying, because you're interacted with ghouls and demons, you're bound to get possessed by the devil, which was obviously nonsense. A worried housewife in deep in suburbia phoned a local radio station, said that having read one of my books, her son levitated. So of course, all the kids, well, for £1.50, we can fly, can we? That's amazing. The local vicar near Penguin Books threatened to chain himself to the railings until they were banned. There were petitions sent in by worried parents saying they wanted them banned. There was magazine articles, the dangers of children using their imaginations too much. I mean, that's insane. One vicar, I can't remember where it was, in southwest of England, was trying to get the whole congregation to burn their books. I mean, it was crazy until, of course, people began to realize they were actually a good thing. Teachers in particular realized how good they were for reluctant readers. There was a survey found that they were increasing children's literacy levels by 20% because of inquiring and curiosity about finding out what certain words meant. It encouraged creative writing, encouraged artists to start, because the art we had in those books was really stimulating as well, the imagination. Over time, people saw the benefits of interactive fiction because of the agency of control and creativity, improved critical thinking, and all sorts of great things that are now accepted. But in the early days, of course, it was a kind of moral outrage.
Did you feel supported by your publisher, or were they also having second thoughts in those early days?
No, the publisher was very, very, very supportive indeed, because they knew that these were actually good and getting a whole generation of kids reading, particularly boys who were never previously interested in reading. And they were effectively a predecessor to video games. It was kind of analog hypertext.
Let's come to your third choice now, which is from 1996. Can you tell us about this game?
Yes, well, that game is, of course, Tomb Raider. I was chairman of Eidos because Domark was massively undercapitalized when I joined the company, and I'd invested in that company. So I decided we'd put three companies together and merge with a company called Eidos Technologies. As chairman, it was my role to concentrate on the content, because I was, you know, the games geek in the senior management team. Whilst we had Championship Manager and a few other games that Domark were publishing, we needed to expand. I drove over to Derby to Core Design and met Jeremy Heath Smith, the managing director, great guy, and he showed me around the studio, and in the last room, you could say kind of rather coolly, it was love at first sight. It was this character, 3D character moving to a 3D world, incredible technology and graphics for the time. Of course, that was Lara Croft, and we acquired the company and we published Tomb Raider in October 96, first on Saturn, and of course a huge success it was on PlayStation. But I mean, it broke kind of all records for numerous reasons: the technology, the graphics. It was a female character created by Toby Gard, who'd seen the rise of girl power and Tank Girl and Nana Cherry, and a strong, powerful, athletic female character was, he thought, was just perfect for the games industry of that time. And of course, it was had the great gameplay. As I said, gameplay is the most important thing for me. And it was the puzzle solving and the exploration and the combat. It was just wonderful. And the way the camera worked in those days and moving away from 2D side-scrolling games suddenly into the worlds of Tomb Raider, it was a phenomenal experience. And it's no surprise, of course, that it did so well.
Yeah, and I remember playing that first one and you first sort of descend into your first tomb and the sense of adventure and Indiana Jones-like discovery of these tombs, and then returning, of course, to your mansion in England with the butler and all of that. It just had such a wonderful tone, didn't it?
And the first time you see the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yes, that was such a momentous scene, wasn't it? And got shared everywhere. As you say, this was the time really where video games start to change from being seen as this quite nerdy thing for young adolescent boys to something else, and Lara Croft becomes, you know, I suppose a marketable personality. I think Marks and Spencer's used her for something around that time. And you know, what did it feel like to see that shift? You've been working in and around games for two decades, and they've always been seen as quite nerdy and a niche thing. You know, was it gratifying to see games arriving in the mainstream in this way?
Yeah, it was brilliant to see the kind of cultural impact it was having, as well as the economic impact. It sold, I think, some 2.5 million units by 1997. Lara Croft, the character, was also being used by major brands to promote their products. So LucasArts used Lara Croft in their advertising and changed the name of LucasArts to LarasArts for a month. It had a phenomenal success on their sales. And some of the biggest brands in cars were also using Lara Croft to promote their vehicles. And the Lifestyle magazine, The Face, used Lara Croft for a cover, the first non-human to grace the covers of The Face, the first digital character. So there's an awful lot of stuff going on around games at the time, part of Tony Blair's Cool Britannia catalogue. And it was just wonderful to see it, that sort of social, gradually becoming socially acceptable by a new generation, particularly that games were cool. So it wasn't just a speaky, nerdy activity. It was mainstream entertainment.
But you're working with different platform holders at this time. How important do you think Sony's arrival was in helping to bring about some of these changes, you mean? Because PlayStation had a very different marketing feel, certainly in the UK, to Sega and Nintendo at that time.
Sony did an amazing job with the first PlayStation. I mean, really did change the game, no pun intended. But of course, software sells hardware, and Tomb Raider was perhaps the biggest contributor to the success of the early days of PlayStation, along with games like Wipeout. And it also widened the audience. As you said, the games were historically seen as young guys sitting in dark bedrooms doing strange things as far as the world were concerned. But slowly over time, we've seen how games have come out of the bedroom, become online, become casual on phones, and very much front and center of mainstream entertainment. And so everybody's now become a games player, to the point where we've got 3 billion people playing games now. We've seen how games technology is helping build the metaverse. We've seen how games technology is part of course, VR, very much so, and augmented reality, and the impact that games have in society as a whole, and technology is being used beyond the games industry and entertainment into training and to education. It's just great to see. But it's not always been that way, but I think that the first PlayStation and the widening of the audience in the 90s really accelerated that process.
In the early 80s, there was a very vibrant video game scene in the UK, the Britsoft sort of era, as it's called. And then, you know, that goes away to a certain degree, and then is, you know, there's a resurgence around the time of Tomb Raider with, like you say, games like Wipeout. And suddenly, you know, Britain once again is creating, you know, really big global video game brands again, Grand Theft Auto as well as another example. What was helping to encourage that, do you think? Was it were there political reasons for that? Was it government support or something else?
There was some government support in the early days. I mean, I think it comes down to the UK being a very creative nation. Look at our film, our fashion, our music, our architecture, our publishing. Did I mention television? and comedy is uniquely creative, and you put a programmable computer into the hands of a creative nation, hey presto, one of the outcomes of that is games. The Sinclair Spectrum was an affordable programmable computer in the 80s, and the BBC Micro was a cornerstone of computing in schools. It's no surprise then that the video games industry got off to a flying start in the UK. We've really punched above our weight as a nation in creating global blockbusters, from, as you mentioned, the Grand Theft Auto to the Total War series to Football Manager to Tomb Raider to Fall Guys. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Unfortunately, a lot of those games companies are now foreign owned because we've not always seen the economic value of the games industry like other countries have, such as the USA, China, Japan. So I think we need to have more support around the industry itself. And the government has helped in recent years with video games tax relief, and there's a very tax advantageous investment scheme. But a lot more could be done. I'd like to see much more PR from senior ministers. You always see that the secretaries of state with their hard hat, high-vis jacket, photo opportunity outside some widget factory, but you never see them inside a video games industry studio. And yet the games industry is creating phenomenal revenues for the UK, and contributes some £7.9 billion to UK PLC, and small studios can create monumental returns, but the profits have been banked overseas rather than banked in the UK.
Shall we come to your fourth choice? Can you tell us about this game and where you first encountered it?
Virtua Tennis on Dreamcast. Dreamcast was one of my favorite consoles, and I just enjoyed the multiplayer element of doubles tennis in Virtua Tennis. It just, again, it was down to the gameplay. You know, the graphics were very good for the time, the animations were very good, but the feel of the game was phenomenal, and I just loved playing it. And you know, we all had our favorite players. I used to play Tommy Haas or Yevgeny Kafelnikov, depending on who I was in. But it was a perfect doubles tennis game, and I have not really played a better one since. Maybe I'm stuck in a time warp, but I think Virtua Tennis was just brilliant for its playability.
Yeah, it's an absolute classic. And, you know, that era of Sega just as well felt very exciting with the Dreamcast, and it was sort of the last, I suppose, push for its big arcade titles, of which Virtua Tennis was one, wasn't it? What are your feelings about the arcade scene and those expressions of public play as well that Virtua Tennis was such an important part of in the early 2000s?
Yeah, obviously it had been an arcade game before it was ported to Dreamcast, very successful. I mean, the arcades in the early days was where everyone played their games. So you would never think back then that could ever end up on a television in your living room, but games did, and that's a great thing. But
I wonder if we'll see a bit of a resurgence of just physical play spaces post-pandemic. I know there's a couple of arcades that have opened in London recently, so there could be an opportunity there, perhaps.
I think physical is returning in all sorts of entertainment phenomenons. And I mean, there's been the rise of board games, what we were talking about earlier, the rise in vinyl records has come back now. I think people need physical and digital in their lives. I mean, I like, you know, physical books has been resurging as well. It's just nice to be able to hold it in your hands and just look at it. And with video games, it's essentially a digital proposition, but in a board game, you get all the components and little bits, and just, and the physicality of it is something special, I think. So you should have both in your life.
You mentioned earlier about how successful companies in the UK, video game companies, are often purchased by overseas larger companies. That happened to Eidos Interactive, didn't it, in the late 2000s when Square Enix, the Japanese company, bought it out. How did that affect you, and how did you feel about it at the time?
Well, I joined Eidos effectively through Domark in 93 and Eidos when we floated in 95 and been chairman and seen the rise of Eidos on the public markets. And then after a couple of missed games that didn't do as well as it should have done, we were eventually bought and ended up finally bought by Square Enix Japan. And I was never going to be the guy who's going to be, I've always been kind of an entrepreneurial spirit and independent thinking, and I don't think Japanese cultural corporations were for me at that time. Although I very much enjoy working with them, I didn't want to work for them. So I left to become an angel investor and started investing in the indie scene in the UK, which was very, very exciting and remains so. And made a couple of good investments, one in Playdemic and one in Mediatonic.
You've been very good at picking winners over your career and backing the right products or the right creations at the right time. What do you put that down to?
It really comes down to a lot of instinct and the playability. I mean, I keep going on about gameplay, but that is what people buy a game for. No matter how good it looks, if it plays badly, no one cares. And therefore, it's important that their gameplay is phenomenal. But in terms of indie studios, I have a kind of basic checklist. You have to assume that the game is going to be great, but then it's the senior management team. Do they have a managing director on an equal footing with the creative director to enable each other to be successful? That's so key. If the managing director or the financial director start deciding what products are going to be making, you kind of likely it's not going to be the right one. But if the creative director thinks they can do it all and run a company at the same time as building our games, they're going to get it wrong too. But it's an equal partnership, their lives were successful. And then it's their attitude to risk, how much they've already invested of their own money into a game, and you know, why are they passionate about it, and how is it differentiable? Do they understand today's business models? Do they understand the absolute critical role that data now plays in analytics and metrics? What's the total addressable market? Is there a multiplayer component? Do they know how to run games as a service? What kind of technology stack do they own? What intellectual property do they own? So there's a whole raft of things that have to kind of be in a line for me to get totally excited. But again, it usually comes down to the two main things being the game itself and the senior leadership team, because people make things happen. Often, you know, everybody has an idea, but it's the execution of the idea that's the hard bit.
I've read, you can let me know if this is right, but I read that you left school with, you only had one A-level when you left school in geography. And then since then, you've, you know, obviously ascended to the highest level of some of these multinational companies and have had a great deal of success. What would you say, I suppose, to a young person who is perhaps struggling at school but thinks that they have skills in other areas? And what might you have said to yourself at that time?
Starting a games company, in my case, was certainly not motivated by a wish to make money. I always wanted to turn my hobby into something which I really enjoyed, into some sort of career, albeit a very poorly paid, difficult career in the early days, and, you know, sleeping in a van, eating hardly anything. I mean, it sounds like hard luck, but we actually enjoyed it because we were doing what we enjoyed. We were trying to build a company on something we're passionate about, i.e. board games and role-playing games. So follow your heart, I think, is probably the main thing. Make sure you partner with people to do the stuff you can't do or shouldn't be doing. So you've got to recognize your own strengths, your own weaknesses, and enjoy what you do. If you don't enjoy what you do, you should do something else. I think fulfillment is from doing what you really, really enjoy doing.
Indeed. Let's come to your fifth choice. This is a game that you had invested in the studio behind it. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's Golf Clash from Playdemic.
Prove you're the best. Download Golf Clash for free and clash at golf. What are you waiting for? It's free. It's golf. It's good. It's epic. Intense. Adrenaline. Vroom. Exciting words. You get to win if you're good. Are you good? Find out and win. Who doesn't like winning? Is this not over yet?
No. Ticked all the boxes of those I just said previously about gameplay, and also had a fantastic leadership team in the managing director, Paul Gouge, and the creative director, Alex Rigby. And this wasn't their first game. And I think another lesson is don't be afraid of failure. Failure is just success, work in progress. Huh. It had that gameplay thing again, the excitement of launching the ball, was phenomenal. It had this kind of windscreen wiper kind of arrow going across screen and a pullback mechanism for releasing the ball, which is very, very exciting every time you do it. And they distilled golf into a game, player versus player, online, asynchronous, but you could see the player hit their shots, and he played over one hole. So it had a very huge potential to be enjoyed by a very large audience, because games only took a couple of minutes, and there was all sorts of incentives to go up league tables. And it was trying to get the investment community to get their head around this potential of Golf Clash at the time. Was not as successful as we would have liked, and we ended up selling the company to Warner Brothers, who then sold it on to Electronic Arts last year for $1.3 billion. Now, this is 80 people in Wilmslow, southwest Manchester, who were able to generate hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue and phenomenal amounts of profit, and wasn't really recognized in the UK. And now Electronic Arts are the benefactors of that incredible success story. But as a game, you know, I still play an awful lot, because at that thrilling moment of just playing one hole and just seeing the ball land where you want it to land, and the pot going into the hole and win.
We often hear these stories of breakout indie game hits, and you know those are stories that are rightly celebrated. I think people are less clear on what role, I suppose, angel investors play in making some of those games become huge successes. Obviously, these days, there are thousands of video games being released every single week via Steam, the App Store, whatever. There are all these amazing avenues whereby a developer can release a game. But how important do you think it is to have a person like you in a game's corner to get it noted and get it out there?
Well, an angel investor plays multiple roles. In my case, it's not a question of just investing money, which is, of course, critical, because it allows the developer to hire the best people, to give them enough runway to release the game when it's ready, rather than having to release it because they're running out of cash. And also, it can leverage my experience in the games industry, the contacts I have, the mistakes I've made, the knowledge I bring around the market and the players and the ecosystems. I like to think I can add a lot of value. I've actually stopped investing now as an angel, because it was impossible to do everything that I would like to have done. So that's the reason I was a co-founder in a venture capital fund called Hero Capital, which was launched in 2018, and we're doing pretty well in that space now.
Just thank you so much for your choices. It's been wonderful to hear your story. I wanted to just ask one last thing. So last year you returned to putting on a creative hat with when Penguin asked you to write a new fighting fantasy book, which I guess was quite a few years since she'd written the one prior to that. What was that like coming back to assuming a creative role on a project?
Well, that's what I enjoy the most, creativity. When I'm not working, I'll be messing around with board game designs or coming up with ideas for a book. But Penguin are no longer our publishers. It's now Scholastic, and it's the 40th anniversary of Fighting Fantasy last year, and I wrote a book called Shadow of the Giants to recognize that event. And it was just, I really enjoyed going back. I mean, it took me longer than it used to take with my age, but I just loved people to their death, you know, fall on poison spice or get fried by a fire-breathing dragon gives me great joy, and try and put them on the wrong foot.
I remember, being when I was young, playing through your books, and you'd sort of try and make the choices that you thought would ensure your survival and enable you to prevail. But more often than not, yeah, like you say, it was sort of being wrong-footed. Did you want players to ever finish the adventure?
Well, of course, I did. I mean, a lot of people cheated as well. I'm sure you did. I used to call it the five-finger bookmark, as people call kind of peeking around the corner if they want to kind of justify it to themselves it wasn't cheating, but that's fine. And ultimately, it's nice that they finally, but I think that people enjoy the puzzle element, and it's not failing at a book. You enjoy the challenge of, if it was just too easy, a kind of linear walk in the park, there's no payoff. But you really fought your way through and solved the puzzles and not being lured to your doom by the evil Livingstone writer, then happy days.
Wonderful. I'm going to very slightly put you on the spot here and see if you would like to give a name to your game console that you've built here. Have you got anything off the top of your head that we could market it as?
A name for my console? God, no preparation. just call it Dice.
Nice. Very good. Ian, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to my guest, Sir Ian Livingstone. What a wonderful chat, and fantastic to hear his memories of his long and very distinguished career in the games industry and around it as well. Ian is really one of the most vociferous and high-profile advocates for video games and board games in the UK, and has been present or at the centre, really, of the advances in the video game industry over the last 4-5 decades. Just such a key figure, certainly in the UK and in Europe. The week that this comes out, that you're listening to this, I imagine, there are a couple of key anniversaries. So it's actually been 40 years ago this week, unbelievably, that Ian and his collaborator Steve Jackson released the follow-ups to their very first fighting fantasy game. So that was in 1983. They released Citadel of Chaos and Forest of Doom with Penguin. Of course, we heard that story of how those books came to be, and the unfortunate controversy that surrounded it at the time that has long since dissipated. And I think most people now can see those books for what they are, which is a great bit of fantasy fun. Likewise, in cinemas right now, there is a Dungeons & Dragons film, Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves. It is fantastic. I went to see it at the weekend and had a great time. I'm not typically a fan of sort of action-y films, but this was funny, smart, well-written, had a brilliant ending, which almost no films have these days, right? It's if you like the idea of Lord of the Rings blended with Princess Bride, then that's sort of the vibe. It's just tremendous. I really thought it was fantastic. A film all about teamwork and love, and a film that really manages to dodge cliche at every turn. Of course, Sir Ian was instrumental. It was him and his collaborators who brought Dungeons & Dragons to Britain and to Europe way back in the late 1970s. So we really have him to thank in some ways for the fact that that film seems to be such a great success. So yes, thank you for listening to this episode and for coming along for the ride. Throughout the month of April, we are doing 2 episodes a week. This is the second one of those. I hope it's not too much hashtag content for you, but it's nice to get some of these timely episodes out to coincide with some of the things that are going on in culture right now, which I think will, you know, is of interest to people, isn't it? You can write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com if you have any comments or suggestions, or you have any guests that you would like to listen to on the podcast. If you have a spare moment, we'd really appreciate if you just very quickly left a rating and a review either on the Apple Podcast app or on Spotify or however it is that you are engaging with this. That really does help. And if you would like to go one step further and support the podcast financially, please head to Acast Plus, search for My Perfect Console, and there you can become an early access supporter for just £3 a month. You can get your episodes 24 hours early and ad free. Okay, thank you again for tuning in. I will be back in a few days with one more guest, their 5 games, and another Perfect Console. Until then, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.